He pulled his gloves on and started his Honda at the same time that Berenson started her Toyota. She had made a right coming in, and therefore she would make a left going out. Reacher eased off the curb and drove 20 yards, and U-turned in the mouth of the next side street. He was stiff from sitting still so long. He came back slowly along New Age's fence. Berenson was hustling through the lot. A block away, he could see Nagley's Honda, riding low, trailing a cloud of white vapor. Berenson reached the wrecked gate and swept through without pausing, made the left. Nagley made a parallel left and fell in 20 yards behind her. Reacher slowed and waited, and then made his own turn and tucked in about 70 yards behind Nagley and 90 behind Berenson. Chapter 66. The Prelude was a low-slung coupe, and therefore Reacher didn't have the best angle in the world, but most of the time he got a decent view of the silver Toyota up ahead. Berenson was driving well under the speed limit. Maybe she had points on her license, but things on her mind. Or maybe the car crash scars were more vivid in her memory than they were on her face. She made a right onto a road called Huntington Drive, which Reacher was pretty sure had been a part of the old Route 66. She headed north and east on it. Reacher started singing to himself about getting his kicks. Then he stopped. Berenson was slowing and her turn signal was flashing. She was getting ready to make a left. She was heading for South Pasadena. His phone rang, Nagley.
"I've been behind her too long," she said. "I'm taking 3 sides of the next block. You move up for a spell."
He kept the line open and accelerated. Berenson had turned into a road called Van Horn Avenue. He turned into it about 50 yards behind her. He couldn't see her. The road curved too much. He accelerated again and eased off and came around a final curve and spotted her about 40 yards ahead. He cruised on, and in his mirror he saw Nagley swing back on the road behind him. Monterey Hills gave way to South Pasadena, and at the municipal line the road changed its name to Villa del Rey. A pretty name, and a pretty place. The California dream. Low hills, curving streets, trees, perpetual spring, perpetual blossom. Reacher had grown up on grim military bases in Europe and the Pacific, and people had given him picture books to show him what home was all about. Most of the pictures had looked exactly like South Pasadena. Berenson made a left and then a right and pulled into a quiet residential cul-de-sac. Reacher glimpsed small, smug houses basking in the morning sun. He didn't follow Berenson. The slammed Honda was pretty anonymous in most of L.A., but not in a street like that. He braked and came to a stop 30 yards farther on. Nagley pulled in behind him.
"Now?"
she asked on the phone. There were 2 main ways to engineer a visit with someone returning to their home. Either you let them settle and then gave them a compelling reason why they should let you in later, or you followed hard on their heels and rushed them while they still had their keys out or their door open. "Now," Reacher said. They slid out and locked up and ran. Safe enough. A lone man running could look suspicious. A lone woman rarely did. A man and a woman running together were usually taken as jogging buddies, or a couple just out having fun. They made it into the cul-de-sac and saw nothing at first. There was a rise, and then a curve. They made it through the curve in time to see a garage door opening next to a house about a third of the way down the street on the right. Berenson's silver Toyota was waiting on a blacktop driveway. The house was small and neat, faced with brick, painted trim. The front yard was full of rocks and gravel and all kinds of colorful blooms. There was a basketball hoop over the garage. The rising door was letting in enough light to show a tangle of kid stuff stacked against the wall inside. A bike, a skateboard, a little league bat, knee pads, helmets, gloves. The Toyota's brake lights went off and it crept forward. Nagley sprinted. She was much faster than Reacher. She made it inside the garage just as the door started back down. Reacher arrived about 10 seconds after her and used his foot to trip the safety mechanism. He waited until the door rose again to waist height, and then he ducked under it and stepped inside. Margaret Berenson was already out of her car. Nagley had one gloved hand in her hair, and the other clamped around both of her wrists from behind. Berenson was struggling, but not much. She stopped altogether after Nagley forced her face down and tapped it twice against the Toyota's hood. At that point, she went limp and started yelling. She stopped yelling exactly a second later, after Nagley straightened her up again and turned her toward Reacher, and Reacher popped her in the solar plexus once. Gently, just enough to drive the air out of her lungs. Then Reacher stepped away and hit the button, and the door started down again. There was a weak bulb in the opener on the ceiling, and as the sunlight cut off, it was replaced by a dim yellow glow. At the right rear of the garage, there was a door to the outside, and another on the left that would lead to the interior of the house. There was an alarm pad next to it. "Is it set?" Reacher asked.
"Yes,"
Berenson said breathlessly.
"No,"
Nagley said. She nodded toward the bike and the skateboard.
"The kid is about 12 years old. Mom was out early this morning. The kid made the school bus on his own for once. Probably unusual. Setting the alarm won't be a part of his normal routine."
"Maybe Dad said it."
"Dad is long gone. Mom isn't wearing a ring."
"Boyfriend?"
"You must be kidding."
Reacher tried the door. It was locked. He pulled the keys out of the Toyota's ignition and thumbed through the ring and found a house key. It fit the lock and turned. The door opened. No warning beeps. 30 seconds later, no lights, no siren. "You tell a lot of lies, Ms. Berenson," he said. Berenson said nothing. Nagley said,
"She's human resources. It's what they do."
Reacher held the door, and Nagley bundled Berenson through a laundry room and into a kitchen. The house had been built before developers started making kitchens as big as aircraft hangars, so it was just a small, square room full of cabinets and appliances a few years off the pace. There was a table and two chairs. Nagley forced Berenson down into one, and Reacher headed back to the garage and rooted around until he found a half-used roll of duct tape on a shelf. With gloves on, he couldn't unpick the end, so he stepped back to the kitchen and used a knife from a maple block. He taped Berenson tight to the chair, torso, arms, legs, fast and efficient.
"We were in the army," he said to her. "We mentioned that, right? When we needed information, our first port of call was the company clerk."
"That's you. So start talking."
"You're crazy,"
Berenson said back. "Tell me about the car wreck."
"The what?"
"Your scars."
"It was a long time ago."
"Was it bad?"
"Awful."
"This could be much worse." Reacher put the kitchen knife on the table and followed it with the Glock from one pocket and Tony Swan's lump of concrete from the other.
"Stab wounds, gunshot wounds, blunt trauma. I'll let you choose."
Berenson started to cry. Hopeless, helpless sobs and wails. Her shoulders shook and her head dropped and tears dripped into her lap.
"Not helping," Reacher said. "You're crying at the wrong guy."
Berenson lifted her head and turned and looked at Nagley. Nagley's face was about as expressive as Swan's lump of concrete.
"Start talking," Reacher said.
"I can't,"
Berenson said.
"He'll hurt my son."
"Who will?"
"I'm not allowed to say."
"Lamazon?"
"I can't say."
"It's time to make up your mind, Margaret. We want to know who knew and who flew. Right now, we're including you in. You want us to include you out, you've got some serious talking to do."
"He'll hurt my son."
"Lamazon will?"
"I can't say."
"Look at it from our side, Margaret. If in doubt, we'll take you out."
Berenson said nothing.
"Be smart, Margaret," Reacher said. Whoever is threatening your son, you make a good case against him, he'll be dead. He won't be able to hurt anyone.
I can't rely on that.
Just shoot her, Negley said. She's wasting our time.
Reacher stepped to the refrigerator and opened it, took out a plastic bottle of Evian water. Flat, French, gallon for gallon, three times as expensive as gasoline. He unscrewed the top and took a long drink, offered the bottle to Negley. She shook her head. He emptied the rest of the water in the sink and stepped back to the table and used the kitchen knife to saw an oval hole in the bottom of the bottle. He fitted it over the Glock's muzzle, adjusted it neatly so that the screw neck lined up exactly with the barrel. A homemade silencer, he said. The neighbors won't hear a thing. It only works once, but once is all it has to. He held the gun a foot and a half from Berenson's face and aimed it so that she was staring straight into the bottle with her right eye. Berenson started talking. Chapter 67. In retrospect, it was a tale that Reacher could have scripted in advance. The original development engineer up at the Highland Park plant was now the quality control manager, and he had started showing signs of severe stress. His name was Edward Dean, and he lived way to the north, beyond the mountains. By chance, his annual performance review was scheduled 3 weeks after he started his weird behavior. Being a trained professional, Margaret Berenson noticed his distress, and she pursued the matter. At first, Dean claimed his move north was the root of his problem. He had wanted a relaxed lifestyle and had bought acres of land out in the desert some ways south of Palmdale. The commute was killing him. Berenson didn't buy that. All Angelenos had the commute from hell. So then Dean said his neighbors were problematical. There were outlaw bikers and meth labs close by. Berenson was readier to believe that. Stories about the Badlands were legion. But a pained echo in a chance remark about Dean's daughter led her to believe that the kid was in some way the problem. She was 14 years old. Berenson put two and two together and made five. She figured maybe the kid was hanging with the bikers or experimenting with crystal and causing big problems at home. Then she revised her opinion. The quality problems up at Highland Park became common knowledge inside the company. Berenson knew that Dean had a difficult, split responsibility. As a director of the corporation, he had a fiduciary duty to see it do well. But he also had a parallel responsibility to the Pentagon to make sure New Age sold it only the good stuff. Berenson figured the conflict in his mind was causing his stress. But overall, he was doing the right thing, according to the law, so she shelved her concerns. Then, Tony Swan disappeared. He just vanished. One day he was there, the next day he wasn't. Being a trained professional, Margaret Berenson noticed his absence. She followed up. She had split responsibilities of her own. Swan had classified knowledge. There were national security implications. She got into it like a dog with a bone. She asked all kinds of questions of all kinds of people. Then one day she got home and found Alan Lamazon on her driveway playing one-on-one basketball with her son. Berenson was afraid of Lamazon. Always had been. How much? She hadn't really realized until she saw him tousle her 12-year-old's hair with a hand big enough to crush the child's skull. He suggested the kid stay outside and practice his free throws while he went inside for an important chat with Mom. The chat started with a confession. Lamazon told Berenson exactly what had happened to Swan. Every detail. And he hinted as to the reason. This time, Berenson put two and two together and made four. She recalled Dean's stress. By and by, Lamazon revealed that Dean was cooperating with a special project, because if he didn't,
his daughter would disappear and be found weeks later with blood running down to her ankles amid a happy band of bikers.